When you have somebody that says that they know about financial advice with student loans, you really just want to ask them to calculate a payment off the top of their head. There's any number of questions that you can ask the person, and usually they'll be caught with their pants down, so to speak. Hello. Today we are going to talk about the 7 student loan travesties, and we're going to spell travesties T-R-A-V-I-S-T-I-E-S. Travesties, as in my name, my first name, student loan travesty. Get it? Ha ha. Okay, I will try to stop with the corny humor because you might turn off, so I got to get into content, right? So remember, if you have any kind of questions, I love getting them, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. Please ask any and all questions you can possibly think of about your student loans, and we will talk about it live. The first student loan travesty is when people fall prey to student loan scams. There are a ton of student loan scams out there, and I'm going to start off by just telling you a little story about our business. This business got started in about September or October 2016. Now, pause for a moment and think about what was happening in America in September of 2016. The election, ding, ding, ding. There was a lot of student loan advertising happening on Facebook, and it wasn't refinancing like it is today. It was everything. All kinds of wild claims and consolidations, and it was just totally nuts. And so I remember that I ran an ad to one of the very first blog posts that I wrote about how veterinarians get screwed over under student loan rules. And with $100 of Facebook ad spending, that one article went viral and got shared maybe like, so I don't know, hundreds of times, and it was seen by 20,000 people. So to this day, that is the most traffic we've ever gotten on the blog in one day. And it was basically every veterinarian in the country, I felt like, read that. You know, what happened is, obviously, you had the fake news scandals, you had the Russia scandal all happen around that time, and Facebook was at the center of that, and they were super, super sensitive to that happening. And so they just put a smackdown on anything that they could think of that might get them in trouble in front of Congress. And the problem with that is they basically were using algorithms to just blanket label a bunch of different businesses. And so we got caught up in that too. You know, it was a good thing in some regards because it eliminated a lot of the advertising strategies that these scam companies used. And so they would promote things like Obama student loan forgiveness and consolidation secrets and how you can get all your loans forgiven and, you know, join the Navient lawsuit or just really crazy kind of things. And they were basically just taking people's money. And these scams, the most successful ones, built people out of tens of millions of dollars. Really kind of amazing how horrible some of these people are, and they just didn't care at all. I mean, you know, a lot of the folks, you know, that were doing these student loan scams, they basically just wanted to make a bunch of money, transfer it overseas, and flee the country if they needed to. A lot of them had kind of dual nationalities, you know, kind of more international type ability to travel. One guy got arrested actually recently at the San Francisco International Airport while he was trying to flee to another country because he had offshored a bunch of the money that he did from his student loan scam. It's just really, really interesting how things were back in the day. So student loan scams are still very present and very widespread still, right? They've just kind of modified how they do things a little bit because of actions that the Federal Trade Commission has taken. And so here's some of the scams that still exist, not just the ones that existed back in 2016 when I was getting started doing Student Loan Planner. The first scam is called a consolidation scam. So I'll give you an example of what this is. We had a client who was advised by this law firm in South Florida. And you'd think, wow, you know, a law firm, they must be ethical, right? They must be doing things the right way. Well, just like there's honest and dishonest people in every profession, the same thing applies to attorneys. And so this law firm in particular was basically kind of running a mill, if you will. So they had a bunch of paralegals doing a bunch of different legal paperwork. And basically what they would answer, what their answer was to everything was consolidate. Oh, you have a student loan? Consolidate it. Oh, you need to get enrolled in an income-based plan? Consolidate it. My payments are too high? Consolidate. I have a cold and my dog's sick? Consolidate. I mean, that was literally the answer to everything. And so what happened was this person had direct loans, had 4 years of credit towards the 20 she needed for pay as you earn, and she came to them for advice and they just consolidated her loans. And you know that when you consolidate your loans, you start over completely on your clock towards forgiveness. So she consolidated her loans and this firm had no idea what they had done. And I showed her how that firm had cost her 4 years of payments at the end of the 20 years that she had added on to her repayment schedule because of that action. We predicted that cost was around $50,000. The thing is I told the client exactly what to say to the law firm and asking for a refund. And the law firm, you know, refused it. And I said, ask again and tell them how much they cost you and let them know you'll be making a complaint to the Florida Bar Association if they don't give you the refund. And when she did that, they gave her the refund immediately because they realized what they had done and how much they screwed her over. So that's an example of a consolidation scam, is a place that just kind of promises all of your problems will be cured if you just simply consolidate your student loans. Consolidation is a tool. It is not a solution, right? You're not going to take a hammer and fix a problem. You might need a hammer to fix a misplaced beam in a house that needs to be nailed back into place or something, but you also might need a saw and you also might need a level. I mean, I'm not a construction person, but you get what I'm trying to say. Another scam, debt elimination scam. And this is, by the way, this is just the seventh student loan travesty. We're kind of working our way from top to bottom here. So debt elimination scam. This is a scam where they tell you that they can eliminate your debt or negotiate, you know, a settlement for pennies on the dollar. This is something that really cannot be done. You can't eliminate your student loan debt. You can't just evaporate it. It's not going to go away. The federal government can actually garnish your Social Security income and your wages and your tax refunds. The government has enormous powers here. Nobody's going to wipe away your debt or negotiate a settlement. There's some very, very rare exceptions, but the people that I know that do that work legitimately are all attorneys, and they don't heavily advertise because they want to let people that are struggling find them versus make promises that they might not be able to keep. Another similar scam, not exactly this, but very similar, is the scam called the advance fee scam. Somebody puts you into a high-pressure situation and tells you that you can pay a student loan processing fee monthly to them, and they will handle your student loan payments for you. So in other words, you pay them a couple hundred or a few hundred dollars a month, and they'll go negotiate on your behalf with a student loan servicer. So basically, you're giving them an advance fee for their service of negotiating your payments. So this is a very lucrative and very evil scam, and it's some of the ones that result in the biggest recoveries or biggest amounts that are identified by the government as being stolen. Basically, what they do is they make you think the money's going to your student loans, but it's really going to them, and they put your student loans into forbearance. And the idea is they put you into forbearance or deferment, and they can do that for like 3 years. And so all the while they're collecting all these fees, and they can say, you know, when you call them, they just say, hey, we were filing your forbearance paperwork for you. We were making sure your student loans didn't default and hurt your credit. What they're really doing is just trying to run out the clock on the 3 years of forbearance so they can make, you know, $300 or $200 a month, whatever it is. That's thousands of dollars. Multiply that by 3 years, you're talking 10 grand per victim. So you go out and advertise a bunch of different places, bunch of low income kind of areas too, where you can get really desperate people that are willing to pay that kind of thing. You know, I mean, they can really catch a lot of people, and middle class areas too. I mean, this is not limited at all to that. You know, you really are just trying to find people who are struggling and are willing to pay anything for help. Another scam, lawsuit scam. So this is a great one I hear a lot. They're like, I want to join the Navient lawsuit. Please let me join the Navient lawsuit. Problem, that doesn't really exist. There's no class action lawsuit that you can join against Navient, not really any servicer for that matter. There might be at some point, but you know, if there is a class, you're not going to be necessarily asked to join it. Usually, at least it's my understanding that what'll happen is you'll have a law firm put together a class action suit, and you'll eventually get notified that, you know, there's some sort of settlement and you're able to get a certain amount of benefits from that settlement. But these class action suits, you shouldn't be expecting something amazing from them. Like, I remember one of my friends, I think, got like $10 for some class action suit against Facebook at some point, I think, some sort of privacy violation. I mean, this is like a joke, like the amount of money that you get for class actions out there. If they're telling you, you know, to pay them to join some sort of suit, basically these scammers will tell you whatever it is they think you want to hear so they can separate you from their money. That's just a general good life rule to remember. They're trying to tell you what you want to hear to trick you out of your money. Student loan forgiveness scam is the last type of scam I'm going to highlight. So this is a common one where they just say, Obama student loan forgiveness, Trump student loan forgiveness. We can help you qualify for the government student loan forgiveness plan. And some of these things are horrible. They'll put something that really looks like it's from the Department of Education, and then they'll put barcodes on it. Like, they'll make it look, they'll put like a, you know, a code on there, like a number, page numbers, and this is form number, blah, blah, blah. They make it look real similar to the government. And the whole goal is to elicit a response from you, you know, to say, wow, I qualify for forgiveness and you can help me. This is wonderful. Because your student loan servicer is just going to tell you what to pay. They're not going to tell you that you qualify for forgiveness. So you're not going to get good advice from your servicer anyway. That's well documented. So this is people basically just preying on folks. And the last little one, this is a bonus one that I just kind of came up with at the top of my head. People just impersonating people. Okay, I'm not going to say details. But we've had all kinds of people impersonate officials, Department of Ed, servicers, private businesses that do help with refinancing. I mean, it's just kind of staggering. Just know that you will never, ever, ever get an outbound call about your student loans. There's very limited exceptions. Maybe if you called the ombudsman, they might call back or something. But in general, you're never going to get a call about your student loans. So anybody who's calling you about your student loans is probably full of you know what, right? Because they're fake and they're trying to scam you out of money. So if there's ever somebody calling you about your student loans, identify who the person it was that contacted you. And instead of calling them back, rather just send an email to the place that you thought contacted you. And unfortunately, sometimes people think that that was us and it wasn't. Full disclosure, like I got hit up a ton back in the day. I've hit spam on so many of these, but so many people have contacted me trying to sell me lists of borrowers, hundreds of thousands of long with phone numbers and identifying information. It's horrifying. Now, I think that probably, you know, the quality of these lists are a little sketchy. Like, I think a lot of the people probably just bought some sort of black market list of thousands of people and just are trying to put it up as a, you know, list of borrowers when it's not. And then also sometimes, and this is kind of scary, but I think sometimes these places are super sophisticated and they just go hire, you know, a bunch of people in the Philippines on one of these freelance sites and just ask them to compile lists of grads they can find online, and they just, you know, try to sell them to people. And the people who buy them are these scam companies that try to hit people up. So it's real scary. I mean, that's kind of one reason that we never ever want to call anybody, or, you know, just because it just makes me uncomfortable with how many scams that are out there, that that's the way that they operate, is just high fee, high pressure sales tactics and stuff like that. Number six, parents lending kids money. This is the sixth travesty. I promise this one won't be quite as long as number seven, but I thought the scam travesty deserved a little bit of a little bit more attention. Number six, parents lending kids money for their schools. I want to give you kind of a case study in this. All right. Classic case study, kid graduated without debt from a public university in California. And then we'll say that the parents immigrated from Vietnam in the 1980s. Okay. And they have a paid off house worth 600, the parents do. They have a paid off house worth 600,000 and almost nothing in retirement. But they've been working, you know, for a long time in the US, and they're citizens, and their kid was born in America. So their kind of idea, the parents' idea for retirement is, well, we're going to have our child or son or daughter go to dental school, right? Or medical school. And that son or daughter is going to provide for us in our old age. And we want to make sure that they don't have a ton of debt. And so we're going to support our child through their education, and we hope that they support us, right? So it's a wonderful kind of mentality. And my wife's Asian American, so I mean, maybe I have a little bit of window into that just by getting to see how she interacted with her parents funding some of her medical school. But here's how that's a huge mistake. And at least it's a huge mistake in a lot of cases, I should say. So let's say that this kid goes to USC Dental School. It's one of the most expensive dental schools in the country. $600,000 to $700,000 expense. And probably a bank is not going to want to give the parents the full amount. So let's say the bank gives the parents $300,000, half of what their house is worth. So they give them the $300,000 mortgage, and then the parents turn around and use that $300,000 to fund their child's dental school at half of it. Basically, they cover half of it. Now you have $300,000 or $400,000 in debt that the kid's still going to owe. Okay, so you graduate. This second generation dentist living the American dream, let's say she graduates and she wants to stay near her parents, let's say in Southern California. Okay. And so moving out of that area is not an option. So you've got $300,000 to $400,000 in student loans, and you have a requirement that you live in one of the most competitive areas to be a dentist in America. And let's assume too that who do most, especially female dentists, marry people that they meet in dental school, other professionals, right? Other professionals with incomes that are similar to theirs, and oftentimes student loan debts that are kind of similar. So that's not a guarantee, but that's certainly a possibility. So if you assume that the other person has a USC-sized student loan debt that they end up marrying, they have a combined $900,000 of student loan debt, obviously they would need to go for forgiveness. And even in, let's say, if they do not end up marrying somebody with student loan debt, then you can file taxes separately and you can pay only on her income instead of both. And, you know, in Southern California, as an associate dentist, you're going to make $120,000 to $150,000. So that's above a 2-to-1 debt to income ratio. And if you do end up becoming a practice owner, you're going to have to borrow probably 100% of the revenues of your practice to be able to take out a loan like that. And you're going to be a lot more limited in your profit compared to other dentists around the country, because you're going to have to pay higher wages for everybody at the practice, higher real estate costs because of how expensive real estate is in Southern California. And you're going to have more competition. So you're going to have to accept more insurance plans that are going to pay and reimburse you at a lower rate. Basically, you know, your income is not going over $200,000. And so you know that you're a forgiveness case pretty much for sure in this example. And so if you have the parents mortgage their home, then all they did was replace the $300,000 of the tax bomb that you'd have forgiven. So $300,000 lower tax bomb, how much is that in savings? So that saves you 40% of $300,000 in 20 years. And it's a little bit more complicated than that, because you could say, oh, well, the interest grows or whatever, but it grows at a simple rate of interest. So it's not like it's compounding or anything. So, you know, you can kind of approximately say, let's say 40%. I mean, we can even say 50%. 50% taxes on 300,000 saved is 150 grand. Okay. And that 150 grand, you're saving that in 20 years. So in today's dollars, you know, you're probably talking about that being worth like $50,000 to $80,000 in today's money. So the parents, by putting up $300,000, half of their life savings, which are almost all in their home, they only got back about $50,000 to $80,000. That's terrible. For those of you that are kind of not math people, that's horrible. I don't think you have to be a math person to understand that's a bad trade. Now, what's even worse is, let's say that daughter went to medical school and she ends up working for UCLA health system. Let's say that she goes and works for one of those places as a urologist or something like that. And she has a passion for working with underserved communities, and she's really interested in kind of working in that kind of health system long term. Okay, well, she's public service loan forgiveness eligible, right? And so maybe her medical school debt wouldn't be as big. Maybe it'd be, let's say it went to USC med school, it's a little bit cheaper. Maybe there's some scholarships, because rich people love giving money to medical schools, not dental schools, for whatever reason. So let's say that, you know, the $300,000 contribution, she would have left with $200,000 instead of $500,000. But if you look at how to optimize PSLF, you'll realize that, you know, even if she's making $300,000 or $400,000 a year, when that point happens, she can still cap her payments. So she can, on a $200,000 balance, she can still pay $2,000 a month if she's on the right repayment plan, no matter how much her income is. That means that pretty much anybody, even that has debt lower than their income as an attending physician, can still get 5 to 6 figures of PSLF. And I don't care if you're a brain surgeon with $150,000 of debt with $600,000 of income, you can still get a large, significant PSLF benefit if you know the rules right. And that benefit's usually 5 or 6 figures, even in those limited debt cases. I say limited debt, I'm just talking below average med school debts. But what that family did by funding a big chunk of her med school is essentially replacing debt that would be forgiven tax-free with their own money. Holy cow, is that a bad idea? And that's actually what happened to my family, my in-laws. I mean, they scraped and saved and sacrificed so that they could help my wife go to medical school with less debt. Not no debt, but just a little bit less debt. And it just so turns out that she had this passion for doing academic medicine, and she was in a PSLF eligible job and certainly isn't leaving that. And so she could have gotten PSLF, and she didn't, because of this messed up thing that happened to her. One, she got bad advice, but two, her parents lent her money when she shouldn't have gotten that money from them. She should have taken out more debt. So that's a huge no-no, borrowing from family, unless here's a situation where it's not dangerous. If you're going to a university with a, let's say, bottom half cost spectrum, So in other words, you're going to a public in-state dental school. You think you'll come out with $200,000 or $300,000 if you finance the whole thing, and you can borrow from grandma at 0% for half of it. You have no interest in working in a kind of academic place. You want to make a good salary, be in private practice, earn a significant income. That's kind of one of your goals. There's nothing wrong with that to just go ahead and say, well, okay, I'll take a little bit from grandma, but you better make sure that grandma and everybody in the family knows that what happens, you know, and that it's all documented if something happens to grandma. Don't mean to be kind of morose or anything, but I was working at a big company for a few years. And when I was in their wealth department that processed things when people died, I saw all kinds of random things with people that had made loans to kids and the person unexpectedly died and the whole family started fighting over it. So make sure all that stuff's written out. But the big student loan travesty here is that parents lend money to kids and, you know, heck, that family that immigrated in this hypothetical example, I mean, they could have had no mortgage and claimed Social Security at 70 and they could have been totally set for retirement. But instead, they're going to be dealing with a $300,000 mortgage. It's going to be at least probably two grand a month that they're not going to be able to pay. So the child's going to have to deal with it. And so then it's a purely additive payment. So that really kind of stinks if you think about it. Student loan travesty number five, financial advisors offering student loan advice as a sales tool. So this is a fun story. I listened to a pod recently. I heard this financial advisor who had a student loan website. This advisor probably, I'm guessing that he made the vast majority of his money signing up dentists and physicians for wealth management services. What is wealth management and how much can people make doing that? The dream scenario for a financial advisor is this. You find, you know, 100 dentist physician families that have $500,000 in assets. You charge them 1% management fees to manage that money. And so that's a $5,000 per year fee. And then now you multiply that by 100 households, and now you're up to $500,000 in revenue. And of course, physicians and dentists, if you can get them to save and invest more with you, then you're going to grow their portfolios over time. And so your fees are going to go up over time too, even though the work involved is not. So you're going to think, okay, well, so the average dentist or physician should maybe have a portfolio of, let's say, $2 million at some point. So now you charge that same 1% fee. And now instead of $500,000 in revenue, now you're looking at $2 million a year in revenue. And so you have enough money to pay some people and have nice rent, nice office space, and still make a ton of money. The problem with the financial advice industry is it's under a lot of pressure right now. There's so many different places out there, Vanguard, Betterment, Wealthfront, Schwab, I could go on, that are charging 0.25% to give you financial advice instead of 1%. And so there's some advice out there that costs, you know, that 1% that's worth it. They throw in wealth management, consultations with attorneys, financial planning. It's really kind of all inclusive and they do a ton of work. And so those kind of examples, well, okay, those people will probably survive. But there's still a lot of people out there that are what I would call average advisors, right? And an average advisor is somebody who's not providing a ton of value over and above what one of these robo-advisors provides. They're kind of the golf players, if I was pejorative about it, right? They just kind of want to play golf all day and have a big book of business and not do very much work. So those people are under a lot of threat. And a lot of these folks are kind of good old boys, and that's the way things have been done forever, and why are we upsetting the apple cart kind of thing. And so those are the folks that feel really afraid, I think. It's always interesting because I get messages sometimes from folks. Sometimes you can tell that people are adding tons of value or great financial advisors, charging fair fees, and those are always great emails to get. A lot of those people disproportionately are humble and admit what they don't know and are always trying to find the right answer for their clients, even if it's not something that they can help with. Those are really fun advisors to talk to. Some of the ones that are not as fun to talk to are the ones that are like, do you provide financial advising? You know, or am I going to have to worry about losing my client to you? I saw that you recommend Vanguard. Does that mean that you're going to try to take my client away? And it's like, dude, if you can't, or woman, you know, not just dudes in the advice industry, even though it is 80% male, and that should be a lot more closer to 50-50 than it is. But I'll say, you know, I mean, if you're that worried about holding onto your clients, then you're probably not providing enough value and you have a lot to worry about besides me. It is kind of interesting with that. So anyways, let's say if you could make a couple million dollars or hundreds of thousands doing financial advice. Here's another example. Have you ever had somebody at your school that was trying to sell disability insurance. There's some people that are specialists in this and are ethical and only sell when it makes sense and all that kind of stuff. I've certainly interacted with several people that only sell disability and that's all they do, and they're pretty good at it. But, you know, I've also had some folks that it's kind of like if you can get a doctor to sign up for disability insurance through you, then you make a four-figure commission because you can get, I mean, it depends on the insurance company, but I'm fairly sure that it's kind of like the first year of the premiums is kind of like your commission. That's often the way it works, I think. So, you know, if you can get a bunch of people signing up for a couple $100 a month policies, then you're talking making, you know, a couple thousand, few thousand dollars off of each person. That's really attractive. And when there's groups out there that are offering student loan advice for a few $100 like us, is it more profitable for those firms to charge for that advice? Or is it better for them just to kind of say, hey, it's free, come talk to us about your student loans, and then we're going to try to sell you something else that we make a ton of money on? So there's a lot of advisors out there that are like that. We get these emails from these people quite a bit because they went and met with the person and the person didn't answer their question, right? Or that it didn't actually go into actual, you know, advice, or they had no idea about income-driven repayment. They didn't understand what the name of the servicers were. They didn't understand the form names. You know, they told them to consolidate it or put it on a 30-year plan, which, you know, or refinance it to the longest term or something. So clearly, like usually the client or, you know, the reader oftentimes will, or listener will contact me kind of feeling like something's off, like the person didn't really know 100% what they were talking about. And so that's because the folks that are stuck in this good old boy mindset of doing business where they're just trying to collect the fees and kind of do some work, but kind of sales-based lifestyle, you know, those folks are terrified of looking incompetent about anything because they're already under so much pressure from earning fees elsewhere in their businesses that they're so afraid of looking like they're not smart about any specific thing. Because if they look like they don't have the answer on something, then they're terrified that you're going to leave them and go talk to some other advisor that will say that they know something. That's kind of the problem that exists, really. When you have somebody that says that they know about financial advice with student loans, you really just want to ask them to calculate a payment off the top of their head. You know, what's the discretionary income definition? What's my student loan payment going to be based off of this income and this debt? You know, what's the breadwinner loophole or what's community property rules and how do they apply to pay as you earn? You know, how do you calculate the repay subsidy? There's any number of questions that you can ask the person, and usually they'll be caught with their pants down, so to speak, because they won't know how to answer any of that. Sorry for the French there, but it's just kind of reality. So don't fall for the travesty of financial advisors that don't know what they're talking about. Number four, travesty of seven, we've got four to go. Number four is online forums and bloggers that talk about how wonderful private student loan refinancing is. I'll tell you another story here. I had a fight with somebody on a Facebook group. It was dedicated to PSLF physicians. So anybody who's listening, that's a great resource. Basically just type in PSLF physicians on Facebook. And really, even if you're just doing PSLF in general, there's a whole bunch of people that share their opinions and their feelings about the program on there. It's something that I like to follow sometimes. So there was this person that just posted on that Facebook group, and she was like, hey, this PSLF thing is not going to work out. I'm so grateful that I just decided to take charge of my student loan situation, and, you know, and I'm paying it back in full. I got an amazing rate through, you know, First Republic Bank. And right away, I was like, oh boy. Because I know that, you know, we have an affiliate relationship with them on our refinancing site where you get a $300 bonus. And I know that they will do like a refer a friend deal, right? Basically, she was like, if you use my unique referral code, then you'll get $200 or whatever it was, plus an amazingly low rate of 3% or whatever it was. And so I replied, I said, well, you know, perhaps you posted this in an error. You know, this is a Facebook group for people that are pursuing public service loan forgiveness. If you've changed jobs and you're no longer eligible for PSLF, then this group isn't applicable to you. And boy, was she mad. You know, she posted back, I think, hey, you know, I know what I'm doing. You know, this thing program's a sham and it's not going to work. And I'm trying to save people and all that. And it's like, well, one, you just want to make money off of your referral fee versus making sure people are doing the right thing. And then two, a 3% interest rate is not nearly as good as negative 10%. And you're telling me you know what's going to happen about PSLF. That's news to me. I'd love to know what your opinion is of Tesla stock too. Can you tell me if we're going to land on Mars in 2040? Because I'd love to know that as well. So it's like you don't know the future. And to say that you do is a lie because you don't. And what you make your own decision for is totally fine. And this is me talking to this person on Facebook. And I try to be a little bit more respectful than this, but you know, I get fired up. You'll know me. And so I said, with a 400K balance, if you're going to continue working for an eligible employer, then you're talking about saving potentially $30,000 or $40,000 in interest and risking, you know, $300,000 or $400,000 in forgiveness. So 50-50 chance that it works out, that tells me that you're willing to give up a projected loss of hundreds of thousands of dollars for the risk that you might pay 1 or 2 months worth of interest over several years in terms of 1 or 2 months salary, you know, an extra interest over several years. So there's a lot of versions of this, where there's a lot of blogs that kind of, I mean, I had one writer that wrote for my site at one point. She said that some of the other sites, websites that she wrote for, they wanted the answer to everything that she wrote to be refinance your loans or take out a private loan. That's so unethical to say that you're going to write something to try to help people and the answer is going to be predetermined and based off of what pays you. That's awful. That's not the kind of way any business should operate, I think. Just be careful with some of these online forums, because people are like internet people, right? They're not the same thing as human people. Like the same person on the internet is totally different in real life, right? Because you can't tell tone, you can't tell body language. People that hang out on the internet tend to have like some forums, like not all, but like that's why troll was invented. People don't troll people face to face, or else you just, nobody wants to hang out with them. But from the internet, it's a super safe thing to do. Maybe the person was feeling insecure. Maybe they were feeling really arrogant. Maybe they feel underconfident about themselves, which is why they're trying to act like they know way more than they do. But whatever it is, just be cautious, right? I'm not saying don't trust anybody, but I'm just saying be cautious and don't refinance your loans when you could benefit from public service loan forgiveness. The flip side of that is, if you are going to refinance your loans, our bonuses are better than anybody's. So if you're going to do it, don't use the $200 refer a friend link. Use the $500 link or the $750 link, right? Or the American Dental Association link that we have when you apply through our site for some of the lenders. I mean, we, whatever the special bonus is, we try to make sure that we have access to it. You know, we're not always going to 100% find every single one, but if you ever do find one, please let me know about it. Send us an email, podcast@studentloanplanner.com, and just tell me like, hey dude, found a better deal somewhere else. You suck. I'd love to get that email, because then I can go talk to that place and say, hey, we try to pride ourselves in getting people the best deals for refinancing, and you're not on our site, and why is that? So basically, just be careful about listening to folks on blogs, websites telling you that everything you're supposed to do is just leading to refinance, because that's what pays them. Number three of the third worst student loan travesty, I'm going to say, is bad exit counseling, or school exit counseling in general. Schools have no incentive to do a good job about this. This would be like if your school did a good job on something that's totally unrelated to what they're incentivized to do. Like your school is probably not going to do a great job in like helping you develop healthy eating habits. It'd be great if they did that. Oh my gosh, that would be so wonderful, right? But like that's not their job. They probably might offer some resources or something like that, but they're just not going to be the ones that are responsible for making something happen that you know would be good for your life. Now, school exit counseling, you might say, well, that's different because they actually have to check a box and actually do that. That's a requirement to have financial aid. And they do that, but financial aid officers, their primary job is to just make sure that the student gets the funds, they follow all of the disbursement rules, they do all the paperwork correctly, and that takes up a ton of their time. I know, because my mother-in-law works in financial aid, and a huge part of her job is just talking to students and families about different ways to get funding and just making sure that they pay the tuition bills on time and, you know, helping people that had to withdraw, like deal with the consequences of that. And so when you're looking at doing the exit counseling, they're also kind of more preoccupied with other things, maybe like getting ready for the fall semester, which is like their busiest time of year all year. And people graduate around June-ish. Already when you're in August, it's just like insane mode. They don't necessarily have time for super detailed counseling. And the ones who do have the time might not have the expertise. And in the past, there was this group called GL Advisor that a lot of these financial aid offices were like, hey, like we're good people. And, you know, again, most financial aid offices, I mean, they're filled with good people that are trying to do the right thing. But everybody's subject to incentives. And if you're not getting paid to do something, then most people are not going to do it. You're just going to have some unique special individuals that go above and beyond. But most people are not going to take the extra effort. With that situation in mind, they were giving access to GL Advisor to their students. And this group would get payments from schools sometimes, but also in lieu of payments sometimes accept that the students were a captive audience and a lot of them were going to sign up with that group. And so basically this group ended up The founder ended up going to federal prison for almost a decade because they were starting some of the first refinancing businesses out there and taking people's money to refinance loans. And instead of refinancing people's loans, this guy was using it to party and buy a yacht or something like that. So he was just stealing investors' money. That's really what brought him down. The other thing that kind of brought them down was just that culture that he created where, you know, he was very greedy, looking out for himself. And some of the, I believe, honest employees from that group actually quit and spun off their own separate business. So it just kind of shows you how interesting that is, that school exit counseling is so bad, but then they try to hire an outside firm and they end up hiring the firm that the guy goes to federal prison. So a lot of those schools that got burned, they're still afraid to bring people in. And some of the ones have brought us in before. I mean, and I say like they're saints because I tend to be a little bit of a difficult person when it comes to talking about student loans, just because, I mean, I feel like the schools have a big part to play in the blame. And so some schools do not want me to ever say things like, I think schools are charging too much and like this education's super expensive, but there is a way to pay it back. And they probably shouldn't have raised tuition as much as they did, but that's what the rules encourage. So you might as well do your best to understand the rules that you need to use to pay them back. So some of those colleges get that I'm trying to help their students and they respect that. And I respect that they're under a lot of pressures and they're just going to charge whatever they're going to charge according to the rules, right? And so at the end of the day, if we can help borrowers, we're going to do it. But you know, a lot of the schools don't necessarily want to talk to us where we could probably make it a lot better for their students. So exit counseling at schools being lousy, that's a travesty that hurts a lot of people. Number two, we're almost done here. Number two, a borrower believing the loan servicer about really anything. That's the travesty that we hear the most, probably. But the one I had in mind on this is a story just that I hear probably every week, which is Fed loan kicking somebody off of income-based repayment or pay-as-you-earn. This is more of a thing for people that are physicians or PSLF borrowers, because what'll happen is you'll have a surge in your income and then you'll no longer have a partial financial hardship. And so what happens is they send you out a letter that says you no longer qualify, and it scares the heck out of people, scares them to death, because then they think, oh, I'm not going to get PSLF. I'm not going to be able to pay based on my income. What do I do? Partial financial hardship is not even what it sounds like. It sounds like you need to have live under a bridge somewhere. But partial financial hardship, what that means is your required payment on your student loans based on an income-driven plan has got to be lower than the standard 10-year plan. So standard 10-year plan is usually around 1% of your balance, of your principal, that is. So if you owe 200 grand, your standard 10-year plan is probably about 2 grand a month. So if your payment is lower than 2 grand a month, you have a partial financial hardship and you qualify for everything. If you have, let's say, a $300,000 income, then suddenly your 10% of your income is more than that. And so then you might not qualify. And so you get this scary letter. Now you might say, ha, $300,000 income, I don't feel sorry for you. Hey, I mean, you should feel sorry for anybody who gets horrible advice from his loan servicer, because you've all been through it. So they'll send the letter and you'll be terrified about not being eligible anymore. But in reality, they send this letter out in error because you just do nothing and then your payment gets capped at an eligible standard 10-year plan. And instead of paying, you know, $3,000 a month or whatever it is, you know, that you would have to pay if you no longer had a hardship, now you're just able to pay the $2,000 a month capped payment. So that is a very frequent mistake that costs people five figures when it happens. And there's all kinds of other mistakes too. We've had people say things like, you don't want to switch to pay as you earn. The government's subsidizing your interest every day and you're going to lose that. That's one we heard. They were saying that you're going to get, you know, a 50% interest subsidy or something like that when the person was not getting a subsidy, because their payment was too high to qualify for one. And they also didn't take into account the married filing separately analysis to get the person the lowest payment possible. So that was a, you know, I think a $20,000 a year mistake, something like that. So do not believe your servicer unless you have very good reason to believe that they're telling you the truth. Basically, whenever they started offering advice, that's where it starts getting wrong. Like, you know, if you ask them, hey, is my address correct? And yeah, the right phone number on file, and is my email entered in the system right? I mean, that kind of stuff, they answer right. But anything more complicated than that, it starts getting wrong in a hurry. Number one of my list of the seven worst student loan travesties is borrower apathy. Okay, and maybe that's 1A. 1B might be borrower arrogance, but 1A is borrower apathy. So this is the head in the sand approach to dealing with your student loan debt. So I'm going to give you an example of this, and please hear me out. So there was a teacher, one of my first clients ever, and she was super smart, had two master's degrees, had served, you know, it was like a district supervisor of like dozens or hundreds of teachers and, you know, of some program. And she was in default on her student loans that were like $150,000 or something like that. I was blown away by that because she was working for a not-for-profit or government job, right? So she qualified for PSLF, and I believe that she was single so that she, you know, qualified for 10% of her income. And so she could have been paying, you know, she's making, you know, probably $60,000, $70,000 a year, something like that. And so she could be paying around $500 a month, $400 or $500 a month, and have that count towards the 10 years she needed to have that full amount forgiven. And instead, she was in default, and that balance had grown from like maybe 70 or 80K to 150 over the course of several years. And so we tried to give her some guidance and a plan. And basically, I think she might have kind of panicked a little bit and not contacted us again for a while. I don't know. I still don't know if the person actually enacted the plan or not. That's really unfortunate because that's, you know, that's a $100-something thousand balance. I mean, we're talking about a huge balance that could have just gotten forgiven. And the debt stressed her out so badly that, you know, she just wasn't able to come to terms with dealing with it, opening the paperwork and taking the first step and just, you know, taking that first action. Don't get me wrong. Like, I mean, there's other examples in this in life where I've struggled, right? Like, playing video games too much or not eating healthy or not, you know, trying to take the first step towards exercising when I'm feeling lazy and I just can't get over that hump. Right. So, I mean, there's things that we all deal with in this regard with fighting apathy on things, but this is so damaging because instead she could have paid $30,000 to $40,000, saved for retirement, had her finances under control. And by the time she contacted us, I think it was like a friend that referred her. And instead she's been dealing with making all these kind of half-hearted payment attempts and wasting all that money that could have been qualifying for PSLF, and her balance is doubled and her credit's wrecked and she's not getting credit towards anything. And the worst part is she could fix it, but she's so scared she just doesn't want to talk about it. That's a real tough example of borrower apathy that really does hurt. And I've seen a lot of cases like this. People sort of, they'll be a little ashamed sometimes, and you really shouldn't be if you've had apathy in the past. Like, that's not something that you should be ashamed of. Just admit it and try to get help. And then when you do try to reach out and get help, just be serious about it and just be ready to be helped, you know, instead of just trying to pretend the problem will go away, because it won't. The travesty 1B is borrower arrogance, right? And so I don't really come across this that often, to be honest. I would say I come across borrower overconfidence a lot. Like, people will think they know what they're doing when they don't. I mean, that's a pretty common problem. Like, people won't know about the breadwinner loophole, or they won't know about married filing separately, or they won't know about how to calculate the repay subsidy, or they won't know about the refinancing ladder strategy where you refinance multiple times. The overconfidence problem is certainly a problem. But earlier on in the business, I would encounter like this borrower arrogance problem where they're like, this isn't a thing. Like, forgiveness is not happening. I know for sure, because the government's never forgiven anything, and the government's always pulled the rug out from under everybody. And every time you can ever find an example, they've done it. And usually I would say like the arrogance kind of, I don't know. I mean, I don't really know where it comes from, but just, it's truly unfortunate when people aren't just willing to admit what they don't know, because I don't know about a lot. Like, I'm not somebody that you should trust for advice on what to do with your pet, right? I'm not somebody that you should trust for medical advice. Like, you know, I mean, all kinds of things I can think of, I'm not qualified for. And, you know, I can try to look up on Google what antibiotic I should take because I have strep throat or something. But at the end of the day, like, I probably should go to a doctor to make that decision. Now, I'm not saying that finance is like medicine. It's not. There's certainly smart people that manage their own finances really well. But I would say that, you know, if you kind of look at some of these travesty examples, just please don't let them happen to you. That's all I ask. Share the pod with one of your friends who might be falling victim to these travesties. And if you, I guess if you need help, contact Travis to fix your travesties. Just kidding. We have a bunch bigger team than Travis. Travis, me, that is, I don't do that many consults anymore because I am trying to create stuff for you, free stuff that you can listen to and share and be better off from. And we also have people that are as good, if not better than I am now at doing the student loan consults. So, you know, if you think about it, you want to go hire people that are as good or better than you if you want something to succeed. Megan, Lauren, Rob, Justin, Ben, all of them are advisors and have all these advanced credentials and are experts in different things. Like Ben knows a bunch about tax. We had him on the pod a couple weeks ago. Megan knows a ton about the paperwork processes and how the servicers will respond to things. Rob knows a lot in general because he's the oldest guy on the team. Just kidding, Rob, if you listen to this. So yeah, we'd love to help you avoid travesties. You know, you can reach out to studentloanplanner.com/help if you're trying to get help with that. So just avoid making mistakes in your student loans. We'll probably have some more questions that we'll do for next week's episode. So studentloanplanner.com/voicemail if you want to ask a question for the pod. And thank you so much for sharing this with your friends. You know, honestly, the goal is to make this as useful as possible. So if you ever have any ideas or things, shows that you'd like us to do, just reach out, podcast@studentloanplanner.com. We'd love to hear your ideas. Thanks, y'all, and don't fall victim to the travesties.